Our guest in the Global Observatory today is Dr. Ahmed Shahid, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Iran. He was named to that post a year and a half ago by the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, and he's in New York to formally deliver to the UN General Assembly his latest report compiled from interviews with hundreds of alleged human rights abuse victims outside of Iran, usually in places with large Iranian diaspora communities. He has had to do it that way because Iran has not granted his request to enter the country. Dr. Shahid, your past reports have uncovered evidence of widespread public executions, instances of capital punishment in juvenile cases, and the death penalty being meted out for what would not be considered capital crimes in most countries. Does your new report find that these patterns continue?
Yes, indeed. What disturbs me most is that the pattern that's been observed over the past 18 months or so is continuing, and if anything, is intensifying. And I'm not alone in reporting these cases. If you look at the Human Rights Committee, the UN Human Rights Committee, which sits in Geneva, their review last year around this time also showed a serious concern about the matters just highlighted about juvenile executions, extensive use of capital punishment for offenses which are not deemed capital crimes, and also serious issues with the judiciary, rule of law, and discrimination, especially with regard to women. So I am concerned that the pattern is one of intensifying or worsening human rights abuses, and with really no light at the end of the tunnel, as it were, in terms of what would get the country to improve its human rights record.
One hears also that these public executions tend to take place in a group. Is that the case?
Sometimes, yes. Just this Monday, we had very grim news that 10 people had been executed, all of whom were executed for drug offenses. And despite a number of appeals by various human rights experts and various other bodies calling for either commutation of the sentence or for a stay of execution and to review the cases. So yes, we are worried that sometimes there are what you may call en masse executions, and more frequently for crimes which would not warrant death penalty under international law. That is, yes, in fact, the case.
Another finding in past reports is that journalists and human rights activists and members of religious and ethnic minorities are subjected to beatings, mock executions, torture, and threats to their families, even including rape. What does your new report say about that?
What I found in my interviews for the current report is, in fact, a pattern of abuse of the sort you mentioned. And this can be focused on journalists or human rights defenders or other people who are subject to interrogation. And the worry I have is that impunity appears to be an entrenched culture in Iran. There seems to be no accountability for actions meted to people in custody. And I passed my report on to commentary to the government of Iran, and their comeback on allegations of torture was that torture was forbidden in the Iranian system, that it's anti-Islamic, it's anti-Iranian laws, and therefore it shouldn't happen in Iran. But they did not actually report to me of any cases where they had investigated allegations of torture and found perpetrators or held them to account for their actions. So I am concerned that there are no safeguards against torture in the country, and whatever exists on paper does not actually hold up in practice.
Is that because, though Iran has laws which forestall these kinds of activities, the Iranians charge people with national security violations rather than with breaking these laws?
There appears to be a practice in certain types of cases. The authorities are willing to actually bypass those safeguards that are built into law. For example, in case of journalists, the law requires that they be given a jury trial. But often, journalists are accused not of media offenses, as they have in Iran, but with national security offenses, which then take the cases outside the regular courts into the revolutionary courts, where these safeguards are habitually violated. Yes, it is because those safeguards are not invoked or allowed to be invoked by referring these cases to the court system outside the regular courts.
Tell me about the suppression of alternative faiths in Iran, and in particular the Christian and Baha'i communities.
Well, to step back a little bit, there are two broad issues of concern with me on Iran. One is the deficits in rule of law, which you just talked about, and then discrimination on a wide range of grounds, including religious faith-based discrimination, ethnicity-based discrimination, gender-based discrimination, and sexual orientation discrimination. On faith-based discrimination, the worst situation is faced by the Baha'is because their faith is not recognized by the constitution, unlike, say, Christians and Sunni Muslims, for example. And because they're not recognized, the government treats them as a cult, and they face a whole range of discrimination and persecution. A large number of them are in prison, over 100 are in prison, for various types of crimes, often to do with, again, national security or public order offenses. In addition to that, the Baha'is are not allowed to practice their faith openly, and if they try to hold assemblies, for example, they can be dispersed. And under a system called Ghazinesh, in which people are screened for ideological commitment to the state of Iran, if you declare that one is of Baha'i faith, then reports I get is that they are discriminated in access to educational services, access to other services, access to employment, and so on and so forth. So Baha'is really face a lot of discrimination and persecution in Iran. The Christian community is also reporting increasing acts of violation of their rights and persecution. Over 300 people are reported to have been detained for the practice of the Christian faith over the past 2.5 years. And this often relates to new converts from Islam to Christianity, for example, or for house-based churches, which often involve new converts. There are reports that assemblies can be raided and people are asked to identify who they are and what faith they belong to. And if they find new converts, as it were, they're often encouraged to return to their faith and punished if they did not do so. So there is a widespread persecution of the Christian community in Iran, especially for targeting new converts and those who evangelize or promote the Christian faith. And certain denominations, such as the Protestants in particular, find more discrimination against them by the authorities. And this appears to be a trend that's intensified in recent years, certainly, in the years following the election violence, for example. And it reflects, I think, a more intolerant attitude towards other faiths in Iran.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has warned that the international sanctions against Iran for its nuclear program may be affecting vulnerable populations in Iran and their access to medicine and food. Did you find any evidence of that?
I have not been able to study extensively yet what the impact of sanctions on Iran has been or is at the present time. But yes, there is anecdotal evidence, as it were, of people reporting that in their case, for example, that they were not able to access certain medications and so on. So there is now growing concern that certain medicinal supplies may be declining in stock or maybe not accessible anymore. And that because of the devaluation of the real, you can understand, of course, as a financial indicator, when the currency is devalued as much as has been done in Iran recently, then the poor groups in the population will find it harder to meet their nutritional needs. So there is concern that if the current sanctions continue the way they are, that there would be vulnerable groups in Iran who would be affected by them to a degree that may not be acceptable. So I intend to ask the government of Iran to cooperate with me in studying the impact of sanctions, which will include a visit to the country to really see what the effects of it are. And I hope the international community will pay attention to the potential there is for a humanitarian crisis to emerge in Iran if these continue in the way that many are concerned that tensions are continuing right now.
What did you find about the state of women's rights in Iran?
Again, that's a subject I'm very concerned about. There's institutional bias, discrimination against women by constitution, by law. They are seen as worth half a man. That is the case in terms of testimonies and inheritance and so on. And although, of course, there's been a lot of progress over the years in terms of women's education, in the past 3 decades, there's been a very, feel like, significant rise in the number of women enrolled in universities. there is concern about the very low economic participation rate, low employment participation of women in the workforce, something below 15 or going down to 12.5 by the last report. So there is concern about access to employment, access to equality of services to women in society. There also appears to be active policy of Iran of encouraging women to stay home. But I must also concede at the point that there are a number of measures being taken in Iran to actually then empower women in that sense through laws and policies designed to protect women's interests. But there is no concession of equality between sexes, and that is a point of concern. And more recently, I have heard reports of a number of faculties, some 36 universities, including some 77 faculties, banning women from certain courses. And that is a concern. And this comes after a year or two of quotas being imposed that, again, limited women's access to universities. So even in the case of higher education, there is now concern that women may be barred from access to this at a level unreasonable in terms of equality. And then there's a continuing bias in terms of their legal status in society. So I am very concerned about that. Also, I'm concerned about the question of girls being married off very early, although in practice the average age appears to be rising for marriages in Iran. The practice of young girls being married still exists. And I am concerned that at age 9, a father or grandfather could write the court to get the daughter married off with the court's consent. Certainly by age 13, girls can be married. And at that age, they can also become criminally culpable. So there is concern about the difference in age for boys and girls in criminal culpability and the age of marriage. And in any case, that those ages being far lower than what is set up by the Child Rights Convention, to which Iran is a party.
There are highly publicized releases of prisoners, particularly at times like Ramadan. Does that mean that the situation of prisoners overall in Iran is improving?
No, I don't think that the pattern of abuse of due process rights in terms of arbitrary arrests, in terms of treatment in detention through lengthy solitary confinement periods, torture or duress during investigations, a denial of fair trial standards, and then vague charges and lengthy sentences with summary trials, that pattern hasn't changed. Nor has the fact that large numbers of people remain on death row, that hasn't changed. The fact that people are given pardon, I think, is something done as opposed to custom, maybe. And it often links with an Islamic festival or a holy occasion, like Ramadan, for example, or an Eid. And I have not been able to really gather what kind of criteria I applied in determining who is eligible for a pardon at these times, or whether or not certain categories of people are denied or denied a pardon during these times. So I don't think the fact that hundreds have been released from prison at a time like Eid festival or Ramadan is an indicator that the criminal system in Iran is improving.
I want to ask you about the research you conduct and how you do it. As I said at the outset, you have not been able to go inside of Iran. As I understand it, Iran has not denied you access. They simply have not permitted you access. How do you conduct the research? Why should we trust it? In other words, how can you assure us that your information is solid?
Well, I rely on a number of sources for my information, and I can go through the whole list if you wish. One, of course, is individual victims, first-hand accounts of their plight or the violation they suffered at the hands of the authorities in Iran. So a large number of them actually are in Iran, and I have left the country as well. So about 25% of my evidence in the reports come from people still inside Iran whom I can access through Skype. And sometimes people have been brave enough to telephone me. And of course, I make sure that those who take a risk in doing so understand the risk that they are exposed to and are willing to actually suffer that risk. But by and large, I'm happy that people who have spoken to me have not exposed themselves to any risk by doing so. I also speak to people who have left Iran as recently as perhaps a week before they speak to me, or to several months and a few years. So there is a huge diaspora of Iranians in Western Europe and North America and elsewhere who are willing to speak to me, who give first-hand testimonies of what's happened to them. And I make sure that I only use accounts I can trust, which independently corroborated and at least have multiple sources of verification as to the event. So there are ways to know this from the account themselves. And some of the interviews can take up to several hours. So through the interviews, you can determine whether or not the person actually is speaking, making a credible claim as to what's been said. This can be corroborated by other independent testimonies, or people can actually confirm that the person who was saying that was actually had gone through that experience. Or a lot of the information comes from people who know that it was their family member who had the victimization or the person who was the victim in this. Then I also look at state reports, information published by the state in its own official media, information published by state in its own accounts to various UN bodies, information published by Iranian NGOs in the country, by Iranian NGOs outside the country, by international organizations monitoring Iran over the long term, and only use that information, which I believe is verifiable from multiple sources and actually holds water. And I'm very happy to say that so far there has not been a factual, if you like, issue with matters I have reported on. And accounts that I have reported on actually have held up to be valid accounts.
You've been talking this morning about a lot of conditions which persist, even though you have reported on them in the past. And that prompts me to ask you, do the Iranians care what the outside world thinks of their human rights record? Are your reports read within Iran? Do Iranians know about you, and do victims try to communicate with you? And finally, along the same lines, I know the Iranians have filed a response to your report. What are the points they make in that response?
First of all, Iran does care about what is said about Iran by others. And those comments coming from the UN bodies, whether it's charter body like what I represent or treaty bodies, Iran does care and try and this is seen by the fact that they are at pains to actually respond in some way to these statements. And that's because Iran seeks to be a leader in the world. It seeks elections to UN bodies, and therefore seeks friends and influence in the international community. Therefore, it does want to be seen in a positive light. It does want to be seen to at least account to what's happening in the country. Now, whether or not they actually will move from there to doing something about it is a different story. In terms of the response I got to my current report, my report is about 23 pages, and the commentary I got was 66 pages, which is just quite heartening at the start. But if you look at it closely, there are three or four points repeated throughout, and they keep insisting that my mandate is not a legitimate mandate because the council had singled Iran out on political motivation, as it says, on the inspiration of the United States. So it doesn't regard my mandate as a valid mandate. That's the first point they make. The second point is that they say for a lot of things I point out in Iran, this torture or due process rights, they're saying they have laws in their constitution and in the legal framework to prohibit those practices. So they put that as evidence to nullify actual incidents of these violations. I don't think that the two actually are consistent, because many countries have laws. In all countries, laws are broken. The real test comes in with whether or not there is a legal sanction for breaking that law. So in Iran, the worry I have is the culture of impunity. So they don't actually tell me that those who violate those laws are held to account, and therefore there are no mechanisms to uphold those laws. And the other point they make about my reports is that they say I'm talking to elements who are hostile to Iran. So they mean by that critics within the country, or dissidents who have left the country, and ethnic groups who may be outside, networked as groups or NGOs trying to promote their cause. So it all boiled down to three or four, types of complaints. And then, of course, the fourth one was that I should respect Iran's laws because my code of conduct passed by the UN requires me to observe and respect laws of the country while I'm on mission. So it's like saying if I was in New York, I must respect U.S. laws because I'm here on UN business. Same if I was in Iran, I must respect their laws when I'm in Iran. It does not prevent me from criticizing or commenting on the human rights content of those laws. So rather than engage in a substantive dialogue with me on the matters I raise, they made this general, if you like, comments on why the matters I raised should not be in the report.
Dr. Ahmed Shaheed, thank you very much for talking to the Global Observatory.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.